not your fault. Maybe it's not mine. Not a chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are right smack dab in the middle of it. Right smack dab in the middle. We are right smack dab.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler with my co-host,
Charlotte Littlefield. Good evening, George.
Yeah, how you doing up there? All right? Thing going okay?
Yeah, doing great. Everything's going just great. Thank you.
Okay, we've got a really special guest tonight. His name is Kent Bain. He's the author of the most dangerous book in the world, 9/11 as Mass Ritual. Let me tell you a little bit about his earlier work life. Was the former art director of the Weekly Standard magazine, where he worked with William Crystal, Fred Barnes, David Brooks, Tucker Carlson, and others for over 5 years. During part of that time, the Project for the New American Century shared offices with the publication. Later on, he would help author portions of U.S. Public Law 111.11. Now, we all know on this network that David Brooks and all those people are neocons, but we're going to let Kent Bain tell you a little bit about his earlier experiences and what he finally concluded by writing this book. Welcome to our program, Kent Bain.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Okay. You worked in your earlier life with this neocon. Of course, that's a bad word on this network, I guess. Isn't it, Charlotte?
Yes, it is.
Anyway, so tell us how you got started in writing this book. What were some of your earlier trials and tribulations? Give us through your path here that you had to go through and jump over things and run around things to begin to write this book and getting it done.
Yeah, I worked with an interesting group of people in Washington, D.C. when I was at the Weekly Standard and was in an interesting place at an interesting time. But the truth of the matter is I wouldn't have recognized the conspiracy at that point in my life if it had been right under my nose. And, you know, it could have been. I was a bit of a latecomer to the 9/11 truth movement. And as I began to research and read a lot of what had already been written and a lot of the good research that had already been conducted, I began to pick up on some things that really hadn't been addressed and pulled together. And just as I began to connect the dots, amazing story began to emerge, and I felt like it needed to be effectively pulled together and put in book form for others to examine. And so that's how I ended up writing this book, and so I'm glad to be able to talk with your audience with it about it this evening.
Yeah, you have some very beautiful illustrations and photographs in this book also, so I applaud you on that. The aspects that you finally reached in here, where there's some psychological aspects and then some occult aspects to this book in your research as it opened up and unfolded in front of your eyes. Tell us about that.
Certainly. As I looked at the events that took place on September 11th, 2001, it became clear to me over time that there had been what I refer to as an occult script, in addition to 9/11 being used to take us to wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. It was also a massive psychological warfare mind control operation that incorporated symbols frequently used in black magic ritual. And that's not, your listeners may be aware that that's not an uncommon practice in, within the psychological operations community, is to incorporate symbols and numbers of power and that sort of thing into the entire operation. And so what we have is the largest sort of public mass ritual psychological warfare operation that the planet has ever seen. And that's in addition to what we already know about 9/11, what it was, what it wasn't, what it was used to do to our civil liberties and our freedoms, and you know, what it did for the military-industrial complex. And so this just adds a new and you know, really disturbing layer of information to what we already knew about the event.
Right. You have some very insightful, there are details in this book, and I must really commend you on that. There are details in this book, and also I was reading the, I haven't read the entire book yet, but I've read bits and pieces of it, and the Pentagon, the numerology involved in there that the occult draws on a lot of times, of 555, that was really extraordinarily good insight, and the inside of that, I believe, is called Ground Zero, is it not?
That's correct.
Go ahead.
Yeah, the name arose from the Cold War, when it was assumed that the Pentagon would be you know, the first target, primary target for Russian nuclear warheads, and so they referred to the inner ring, the inner courtyard there at the Pentagon as Ground Zero.
And I believe the courtyard is 5 acres, also, if I'm not mistaken.
You're correct.
Now, the planes, and as far as all of this, there are just a lot of contrivances and a bit of a hoax at points in the planes and the passengers on those planes, and even a 747 flying into the Pentagon. Is that possible?
Well, there are, you know, a number of experienced pilots who say that it's not that the characteristics of the plane that was supposedly involved, you know, that the airframe wouldn't hold up under those conditions at those altitudes, at, you know, at those speeds. And there was one pilot in particular, 20-year veteran of a commercial airlines, that got on a simulator and tried to repeat the maneuver that the 9/11 hijacker supposedly performed, and it took him 20 different tries before he could even hit the side of the building, and that was, he had to deviate from the flight path at that. So it, Hani Hanjour, the hijacker that supposedly piloted Flight 77 into the that wing of the Pentagon, he, according to various flight instructors, he couldn't even fly a Cessna. They said he could not fly at all. So even if you could fly a commercial airliner into the side of the building, you know, along the path that the radar trace indicated, the person that supposedly did it could not have done it. So there are so many unanswered questions, and there's so many holes in the official story, it's not even funny.
Right. An early prophet of this 9/11 was Michael Hoffman. He's a former reporter for the New York Bureau of the Associated Press. How does he enter into your research and so forth?
Well, the 9/11 was not the first event of this nature. It is the most well-known, and it was probably the largest and most spectacular by any measure. But Michael Hoffman wrote very effectively well before 9/11 on this type of event, and on the symbols and the symbolism, really the purpose of these types of events, and what the globalists are seeking to accomplish through them, and revealed a lot about how they think and how they plan for these types of events. And so, even though he didn't write specifically on 9/11 in his seminal book, Secret Societies and Psychological Warfare. It could have been written about 9/11.
Okay, we've got to take a break. Thank you. Yeah, I'm George Butler. Welcome back to the Secret Truth.
Okay, and I'm Charlotte Littlefield. Welcome back to the author S.K. Bain. We're discussing his most recent book, The Most Dangerous Book in the World, published by Trine Day. Welcome back, sir. Okay, yeah. George, are you with us?
Yeah, welcome back, Kent. Are you there?
Yeah, I am. Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, Charlotte was a little late there on that. There were very interesting stories throughout the book, and one in particular was Ted Olson's experience and his wife that was on the plane that hit the Pentagon, I believe. Tell us a little bit about that. That's really intriguing what you've come up with there.
Well, Ted Olson was the Solicitor General for the United States under George W. Bush. And his birthday, it just so happened, was set on September 11th. And his wife was a prominent conservative commentator, appeared on a range of shows, including Politically Incorrect. And Barbara Olson was on Flight 77 that morning, as it happened, according to the official accounts. And she is the source by which we learned that the hijackers had taken control of the airplanes through the use of box cutters. There are a number of things about that account that are very suspicious. There's conflicting information from different reports that were done about it, and including questions about whether it was even possible to make a call from the type of plane she was on at that time. And she was reportedly killed in a crash at the Pentagon. And Ted Olson was, of course, very prominently featured in the reporting that took place after the event, and it was just another aspect of the what I refer to as the mega ritual. There's a lot of things to be suspicious about regarding that particular component, but then when you stand back and look at it, you see that type of thing repeated throughout the day's events, and in conjunction with the numbers and the symbols that were incorporated into the Pentagon event, and then you see similar things that took place with the Twin Towers and with Flight 93 in Shanksville. A pattern emerges where you see that the orchestrators of 9/11 are using dark humor and mockery as part of the overall program. And that's kind of hard to get used to. It's difficult to understand that with all the people that died that day, and with the practical objectives that the perpetrators had, that they would have been up to this kind of thing as well. But I document very clearly throughout the day's events that this type of thing was purposely woven in, and sometimes it was just for kicks, just for laughs on their part, and then sometimes intended as mockery, and then sometimes as a way to generate, I guess, a cognitive dissonance. So it's part of the psychological warfare programming, where there are absurd elements that confuse us and keep us from even beginning to be able to figure out exactly what was taking place.
Right. You have treatment here, and you write about George W. that day down reading a book. Tell us a little bit, how would that tie in? And what would he reading to the children? How does that work out in the occult types of mechanisms and techniques?
Well, it's an event that you have to view and understand in context of the overall occult script for the day, but once you're familiar and you kind of catch on with what was being done that day, you notice that George W. Bush was down in Sarasota, Florida, and he was supposedly on an education tour and just in a classroom of second graders there in a Florida classroom. But there are a number of things that are very interesting about Sarasota itself, including the fact that the lead hijacker on Flight 11 took part of his aircraft training in Sarasota and some additional training just a little bit south of there in Venice, Florida. But in the classroom itself, they were reading a children's story entitled The Pet Goat. And both in terms of the content of that book, which, you know, is seemingly sort of innocuous until you understand that it's, you know, the goat is a symbol of Baphomet, the goat-headed deity. When you begin to analyze the symbols that were involved and then the way that the reading was done and then place that in context of the other ritual elements of 9/11, it becomes clear, and I articulate this more effectively in the book, but that he was really presiding over the entire event, and that in sort of as a black mass, and that that ritual reading that the children did for him there in the Florida classroom was part of a black mass, which of course is a parody of the traditional Catholic mass. And so, again, it's more mockery. It's more just black, morbid humor. And, I take great pains to, in the book, to articulate the occult rationale behind these things so that it doesn't just seem like it's is something that's hypothetically possible or it's not. These are not tentative links that I'm drawing here. They're, well-founded in occult thought practice and writing. And so I'm able to, to lay it out in a good bit of detail for the reader.
Right. It's logical that if this was his script, then he had to complete the script before he could do anything else. Would that be logical?
It would be.
See? So that's why he didn't quit right then. Go ahead, Chuck. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, I noticed during the reporting on 9/11 that there were people trying to make George W. Bush seem very foolish because the book itself was supposedly held upside down.
Well, I looked into that, there was an event. It was a different event where he had the book held upside down. In this particular, on this particular occasion, he did have the book right side up and. Given what he was supposedly doing, he would have been paying attention in this instance because he was, it was reading
Now, how would you describe the look on his face? What words could you use to describe that look?
Well, the picture that we include in the book, you'll see a very knowing look on his face. It's a devious look, and there are a series of photographs that were taken in the classroom that morning, and for someone just sitting listening to a group of second graders read a book about a goat, I don't see how you get a...
Welcome back to the Secret Truth. I'm George Butler along with my co-host
Charlotte Littlefield, and welcome back to author Ken Bain. We're talking about the most dangerous book in the world, which he wrote, and welcome back, sir.
Thank you.
I had some observations that I had done in my research after 9/11. George was all over this in 2001, and so he was in my ear telling me, they did 9/11, so to speak, and... but at any rate, I found out through my research that the first inauguration of the constitutional president, George Washington.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually held in New York in a federal building, and later that afternoon it was on, let's see, it was April 30th, 1789, and George Washington consecrated our country in the chapel at the time called St. Paul's Church, which is now the Parish of Trinity, which is at Ground Zero.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the actual location. It was overseen by a chaplain of Congress that had just been appointed. He was Episcopalian bishop who had been chosen for this act just the week previous to this. And it was very interesting that at the chapel, of course, George and I had been to Ground Zero, and it survived the collapse and everything. But I just thought it was interesting that a religious service of consecration by our George Washington was done at that location to consecrate our country.
Yeah, and there are a lot of very interesting things about the Ground Zero, of course, and then the area around it. And so that's an interesting observation.
After the destruction and the rebuilding, would it be some kind of a phoenix destroyed and the rebuilding of the phoenix or something like that? Is there any kind of an angle there in what played out, you think, here?
Yeah, I do.
Stargate theory.
I think you're right on with that. Of course, they're in the book. I talk about Ground Zero and that immediate area as being a sort of a sacrificial center or a ritual, a temple complex almost, because it wasn't just the Twin Towers that were involved that day. There were the buildings surrounding the Twin Towers, the buildings of the World Financial Complex, World Financial Center, that have occult symbols on the top of each one of the buildings. There's the Millennium Hotel, which I have an entire chapter on that and what it represents. But so there were multiple buildings with symbolic significance there, surrounding the Twin Towers, which were, of course, destroyed. And so we could view it really as a sacrificial ceremonial center. And, they're not done with it. They're building in the process of completing the Freedom Tower that has a hexagonal design. And if you look at it, it's really composed of a series of upward and downward triangles, which is a three-dimensional representation of the as above, so below principle. And they're definitely not done with Ground Zero. I don't know if they're through for the moment, sacrificing people in that particular location, but it's definitely still a very powerful location for the occult-minded globalists.
The new building, could it be described as the new temple rising or something like that, or what,
I think it could. I mean, it's going to be 776 feet tall, which, of course, that was the founding of the United States, it was the founding of the Illuminati, and more importantly and more pertinently in this situation, it's the 1776 refers to the founding of that organization and not to the what most people think it refers to. And it'll be interesting to see who the tenants of that building are and really what happens over time in that area and to the Freedom Tower itself.
They're building a surveillance system in lower Manhattan in the financial district that's going to rival anything ever built in London, according to the New York Police Department. So that's just a side tidbit of knowledge there. But getting back to the actual towers themselves, so there's only one gigantically high tower now. And Charlotte helped put up a third beam up there in 2010. And we went up there and did an international, you could call it International 9/11 Truth Conference. And we broadcast from the INN studios. up there that year.
Right.
And that was quite interesting. Charlotte, boy, I tell you what, Charlotte was, she flew up there from Kansas City had to lay down going up and coming back. She made a lot of sacrifices. Now, what other...
Yeah, back to the book. I got a question.
Yeah, what do you got?
Okay, concerning the tower, of course, we all know that in the tarot, it's a single tower. And so there was the complex, you know, having two twin towers, you are very specific. You tie in two wars, two towers, Gemini, these type of things. Can you tell us a little bit about what Gemantia is? Is that, am I pronouncing that right? The number system that the occult frequently uses?
Yeah, Gematria, they assign a number value to a letter and then add that up. And then so, a number can be said to represent a particular word. That's kind of a poor explanation of it, but that's it in a nutshell. And they use that. That's just one of the techniques that they utilize in occult rituals and for various other purposes. But there were specific numbers utilized that day that were connected with the planes. Most prominently with Flight 11, Flight 77, 93, and there was also a Flight 85. That I've got a chapter on that most people aren't aware of, that it was a Korean Airlines flight that was under fighter escort and ordered to land in White Horse, Yukon. And so that, but these numbers have very specific meaning in the occult thought and practice, and very specific meaning to Aleister Crowley in particular, and he's a pretty consistent presence throughout the occult script for the 9/11 mega ritual, and I've got some good information on him in the book as well.
What about this plane 98? Yeah, what about this plane 85? What's that about? Flight 85.
Well, it's a kind of a lengthy story, but it was broadcasting or squawking the international code for hijack that morning, and there was communication back and forth between the towers and the plane, and eventually the plane was put under U.S. fighter escort and was ordered to land at White Horse, Yukon, at the international airport there, and that, of course, since that didn't take place on U.S. soil, most people aren't familiar with it. But I've got an entire chapter dealing with that, and there are just quite a few really interesting details about the whole scenario. It's a whole additional chapter to the 9/11 script that just doesn't make any sense. There's, all sorts of absurdities associated with it. And so that's a fun, partially fun read as well.
Okay, well, we're going to take another break, Kent, and come back. Kent Payne, I tell you what, this is quite a book. We'll be right back. Thank you for being with us.
Charlotte Littlefield, and welcome back to author Kevin Bain. The book we're discussing is The Most Dangerous Book in the World. I would like to say that we really, just like in your book, I just received it yesterday, and I'm afraid I wasn't able to make it all the way through, but you stress that it's very difficult to explain and to perceive just how huge of an event, of a mega, the word mega ritual is very good descriptive word. One of the, and I apologize, I'm not, I did a lot of research on my own independently, and then I've been reading your book, and I apologize, I think I got this out of your book, but forgive me if I didn't. During the Shanksville, there was a eyewitness testimony about a woman who was driving on a rural road.
Yeah.
And she was overflown by a white craft. Was that your book, sir?
That's right.
Okay, can you please elucidate, because I thought your comment was very poignant and important, and it sort of alludes to how huge this is.
Tell us that.
Yeah, I'd be glad to. There was an eyewitness, unnamed eyewitness, and you can probably still find the video on YouTube if you search for it, but she claimed to have been driving down a rural road that was not far from the crash site in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, when she was coming up to a T in the road and was stopping at a stop sign, and all of a sudden a white corporate jet flew so low over her minivan that she dove to the floorboard because she was afraid it was going to hit her vehicle. There were a number of very interesting things about the craft that she observed. And first was that there didn't appear to be any details on the craft. It was close enough that she could have seen, some of the tails in the panels and the windows and those sorts of things. But it just appeared to be, a facsimile of a corporate jet, or just a craft that appeared to be a corporate jet, because one of the other things that really stood out to her was that it maneuvered in a way that a corporate jet could not have, and it flew under telephone wires. It came up to the T in the intersection after just, missing her vehicle by, several, maybe a dozen feet or not quite that close, but she it went under the telephone wires, and then as it banked to go upward again, it produced no discernible wake in the leaves in the trees across the intersection. And what that says is either somebody put a lot of effort into fabricating that story as some wild disinformation to make us either to throw us off track, or to just create this fog that keeps us from having any clue as to what actually happened that day, or she was telling the truth, as an actual eyewitness, and there were technologies used on 9/11 that the public is not even aware of. Some of the the alternative, conspiracy researchers would be familiar with anti-gravity craft and that sort of thing, that, where a vehicle might be able to have those sorts of flight characteristics. And so either one way or the other, whether it's creative disinformation or an actual account of, some high technology being utilized on 9/11, it was a pretty interesting sort of side note to the whole Shanksville incident.
Right. Why is it that the public can't understand this 9/11 and see it for what we think it was, and we'd say an inside job or a false flag operation? Why cannot the public see that? Yeah, what is that? What's that? Why is that? Can't?
Well, most people just don't have the background to understand an operation that is this sophisticated, and that's one thing that the orchestrators of the event counted on, and one reason why to this day no one has been held accountable for anything related to 9/11. It is disconcerting. I mean, to be fair to the general public, it can create insecurity within you to think about your government or elements within it being involved in an act such as this, is part of the overall framework for this. I mean, 9/11 was designed to create trauma. It was a sort of a trauma-based mind control operation. But the effect on the public and the public's sort of resistance to looking deeper, you know, we need to have some sympathy with them, but then still try to push them to look closer and look deeper. But the fact that most people don't want to hear about it, they don't want to hear about conspiracy theories, 9/11 conspiracy theories, they don't want to, you know, hear about any you know, questioning of the 9/11 Commission report. That, you know, that's a huge problem, but then it's a huge asset to the people that pulled it off and that are doing similar things to this day, including Sandy Hook. They count on that, you know, the public's ignorance and apathy regarding these matters in order to provide perfect cover for them to just do, 9/11 and all sorts of, you know, follow-up events that, you know, we've been subjected to over the last 10 and 11 years.
Right. It's so preposterous. It is, isn't it, Charlotte? What'd you say?
It just keeps re-traumatizing. The engineering synchronicities that you talked about are, I mean, essentially that's what you're saying, and you said so in the book. You know, it causes people to do a double take, and then they go back to their media and do sleep, that you call it. And during my studies, I did look into the occult aspect of this for several years, and one of the things I learned was that the word itself, media, has a connotation of, like, meaning coming to you through the air unseen.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I thought was kind of odd. But anyways,
that's
the
really
rabbit
good.
Hole, you could go, but grammar, I'm sorry, please respond.
No, I said that's really good.
So yeah. Would media
yeah,
be like electromagnetic? Would media be electromagnetic waves then, a radio wave? Would that be media? See?
Yeah.
See what I mean? So I'll tell you what clearly has been operative in this whole last century, so to speak, is that when they were able to, on a remote basis using radio and television, to begin to influence people and, you know what I mean, mind wash them and, you know, mind control and so forth, then they could go all over the world, you know, and do it all. The same idea could be conditioning the world public all at the same time. And that's a very powerful tool, is it not?
It is, and of course we saw, you know, that, I mean, this is certainly not just limited to the United States. We saw the, you know, Great Britain's version of 9/11 with the 7/7, you know, London railway bombings, and more, you know, of course, more recently in London, we had the 2012 Olympics, which was not a false flag attack, but everyone thought there was going to be, which was probably just as good. And there, the ceremonies, the opening and closing ceremonies for the Olympics were just gigantic occult spectacles. So, yeah, they used the media just various techniques, mind control and psychological warfare to influence us through, you know, whether it's through the television, the movies, music. They have so many tools available to them, and they utilize them all just very effectively and seamlessly.
You know, that's important. Kent, if you watch the Olympic Games closing ceremony in Barcelona, I forget what year it was, they had devils with torches walking down in a darkened stadium field there with torches, lighted torches, with horned devils coming down the stadium stairwells. And then coming together in the center in circles, and the dragon was there. Oh, man,
wow.
They had about occult stuff. Go in there and look at that video sometime. But was there any closing comments you wanted to make? You got about 45 seconds.
If your listeners would like to, send me an email, they can go to the website for The Most Dangerous Book in the World, which is just themostdangerousbookintheworld.com. There's a contact form there. I've also got a blog that I post to on a regular basis. And so I would love to hear from any of your listeners. Would also encourage them to kind of keep up with current events, my observations on Sandy Hook and Aurora and those types of things. And so I've enjoyed being with you. And
okay, we certainly appreciate it. Charlotte, any last comments in a second. Okay. Thank you, Ken. Bane, you did a great job.
That was S.K. Bane and his book. And my gosh, it was a blockbuster book. I mean, the thing was overwhelming. The most dangerous book in the world. And it was about 9/11 as mass ritual and Trinday Publishing. You can go in there, trindaypublishing.com. But anyway, S.K. Bane was the former art director of the Weekly Standard magazine. He worked with William Crystal. He worked with these neocons. But this guy today, we had him on the program because after reading his book, I couldn't do anything but applaud it. I mean, it was so insightful and so dynamic that, I couldn't do anything else. But anyway, listen here to S.K. Bane's book, The Most Dangerous Book in the World. It's about 9/11 ritual, mass ritual. Listen to this. Okay, we're back. This was a rebroadcast from January of 2013, January 26th, 2013. And it was one of our most insightful interviews that Charlotte Littlefield and I have ever had. The guy was so dynamic and said so much insightful about the 9/11. We went back and forth quite a bit because we've been studying this, Charlotte Littlefield and myself, for a number of years. We've done three international 9/11 truth conferences, so we have a little bit of an understanding about it. What's mystifying about 9/11 is that more people are not snapping on to what is going on as far as it being, say, an inside job, which I believe there was government involvement in planning than carrying this out. To bring down those towers took more than just planes crashing into them and so forth. But what's sad about this is that more people are not awake. So I started the other day. I woke up in the morning. Sometimes I do some of my best thinking early in the morning. I started thinking about why is it that more people can't see this, what's really going on. And I begin to think about what the problems of trying to work through this 9/11 so-called truth is. And most people are out here working hard, trying to earn a living, putting food on the table, take care of their children. They're under all kinds of pressures and so forth that previous generations didn't have. We all have the problem of survival. But today it seems like with all this media hype and actually television in prime time, my gosh, how can they even look at some of that? I mean, I can't believe that our public is so engaged in such trash TV is what I call it. I can't see it as anything to waste any time on. And so, but recently a friend of mine, I want to thank Scotty out there, Scotty F. Thank you, Scotty F., for helping me get into a theater, the America movie. I wanted to say a little bit about that, too, this evening. Not only I wanted to present this rebroadcast, the S.K. Bane's book, The Most Dangerous Book in the World, 9/11 Mass Ritual, but the America D'Souza, Dennis D'Souza just recently released this movie called America. What would we be without America, you know, and so forth. And wanted to make a few points on that. He brought up these indictments that different groups have bandied about here in the last couple of decades. And he's talking about the Indians, about us taking over and pushing the Indians and mistreating them. And I think there is proof and there's evidence that that was the case. I think they impregnated some blankets with smallpox one time and gave it to some Indians to get rid of them, you know. And that's no way to treat anyone, whether you've conquered them or not. They, time and time again, they made treaties with the Indians, and both sides probably didn't live up to their agreements and so forth. But the Americans had the power, had the force. And he makes one point, D'Souza, in this America movie, that there's conquest and there's creativity. He thinks that that you create wealth through conquest, and that's what, you know, America started out, coming in, pushing the Indians out. We had better weapons and so forth. And then he says the way to really create value or wealth is through creative methods. Of course, that's after you have a country that you can operate within. And I think that will be America's saving grace, is I believe America will come back and do very well in creating new products and goods. If you go into Indiegogo and you go into Kickstarter and you go into GoFundMe and all these other mechanisms out there, you'll begin to see there's a lot of little gadgets and little electronic things that people are inventing that you stick into a USB port or whatever. And so this is the strength of America. We're going to come back. We've got to get over this in some way, though. We've got to begin to face this 9/11, and we've got to start processing that in the right way and start trying to put it in its correct perspective. I know it's not anything that and this is where I'll be speaking to you, my listening audience out there. It's not anything that's pleasant to think about. Let's face it. Nothing like this is ever very, you know, nice and pleasant. And it's depressing sometimes. It gets very depressing because we wonder, what in the heck are we doing here in this country? Now, and then here's where creative imagination comes in. I called up a talk show the other night, one that's well known across America. They have about 200 stations. And we started talking, and they were talking about the flags up here on the Brooklyn Bridge. And I said, well, it looks like to me that America is faded. This symbolizes the flags were faded, you know, and that we're close to losing our country. And there were other perspectives that were phoned in also. And then I went on and I began to talk a little bit about what's going on over in the Ukraine and our other hour tonight was a compilation of two audio clips. One was by Dr. Brzezinski and the second by Alice Jones, and they fit so well together. So I don't want you to miss those. You can go come back in if you miss one, you know, on this air broadcast. If you miss 1 hour or the other, go back into our site, The Secret Truth, and pull those up and listen to those two presentations. But Brzezinski was talking about security, you know, European-American security in the future. And actually, their policies actually drove the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union, now Russia Federation, to the east to seek alliance partners in the form of India and China. And we should have integrated them into Western Europe, but it didn't happen. We ran in there and did all this NATO stuff. But anyway, getting back to America, the movie, okay, it had some very interesting aspects to it. De Sousa lays out these indictments about our acquisition of the Mexican land, you know, through warfare and so forth. There again, conquest is it. I mean, the force of arms wins. He lays out the thing about slavery, and the point he makes there is that, well, there were indentured servants that were brought to America, and they had servitude like slavery for 7 years until they could be released. There were a few that were never released, and so he makes a point about that. He goes through these different indictments of America, and then comes back with a refutation of he refutes these different assertions and these different opinions. So overall, the movie, and then the movie starts off with some American Revolution enactments, which are fairly well done. They could have been better, but overall, it's a primer for some very important points, I think, that all Americans need to go to and sort of reacquaint themselves. And what it does do is it takes this political correctness and turns it on its head And I think that's one of the strengths of the movie, is that instead of laying down and rolling over, you know, like Al Gore does with An Inconvenient Truth and leaves out the middle of the hockey stick there, instead of just rolling over and going with the flow, and Denise D'Souza is trying to make some sense out of this. He's only newly, you know, new to America. So some of the nuances and some of the customs and the culture, I believe that he's not right on top of. But he is doing things. He's trying to make a difference. He is in, he was in an indictment recently. I think he made a plea bargain or something with the feds. He had violated some election code. So that was not a smart thing to do. But anyway, I would recommend to go to the movie and to get the most out of it. He didn't get into really important things, like he got into capitalism, you know, somewhat. That's another indictment that he had, and he had Michael Moore up there. Of course, Michael Moore's recently been exposed to having 9 houses and great wealth, and he and his wife are getting a divorce. And so here he is knocking capitalism, and he operated within a capitalistic system. Where could he make $40 or $50 million anywhere else but America? And then he's out here knocking everybody. This idea, there was a recent meeting in South America of 130 ecological organizations, and they declared that to put an end to capitalism, to end capitalism. And they're coming from this idea of ecology, ecological, the you know, environmentalism, that that the system of capitalism is detrimental to the environment, so to speak. That's sort of the gist. I also will have that up there. That's up right now, those downloads from that meeting there and in South America. And you'll be able to read those statements there. It was held in Venezuela, Hugo Chavez's country, and there was 130 ecological types of organization, primarily South America. And most of the names are in Spanish or Portuguese, so that that tells us that it was primarily South American ecological. And they and then what has fueled this thing is that they're attacking, when they attack capitalism, I mean, just visualize or try to imagine some Hispanic lady that's over here trying to establish a dress shop in downtown Austin, Texas, or San Antonio, Texas, that takes and saves and gets a little capital together and goes out and has enough money to make deposits on rent spaces and buys a few dresses and buys and sells and begins to build a dress shop. Well, isn't that capitalism? My gosh, small businesses have been started from very small beginnings. Large businesses have been started from very small little dress shops. I mean, whole department stores began somewhere. So to knock capitalism generally is not well founded. The crony capitalism that we're suffering under is what should be brought and be acknowledged as the real culprit. When we started owning, when these elitists, so-called international financial elitists, started owning our central banks, then they monopolized that money creation system, and then they could monopolize all business. So unless you fell into to the crony crowd, so to speak, you wouldn't get any loans. So you had to serve them and bend down to them and bend your knee to these crony capitalists, or you weren't going to get any loans. And especially in Texas, I will agree with the Hispanics out there that are mad as hell. The good old white boys owned all the banks here in Texas in the early 1900s. So they used that as a mechanism to shut out anyone that they didn't like or that differed with their philosophical political system. And they gave them nothing, see. And that was the good old boys operating out of mystery school systems and secret societies and so forth that had a lot for a long time on the banking system in Texas. So anyway, this America movie, it takes on some very large subjects. It provides some answers, and the Indian question His answer there is yes, other Indian tribes were at war with other tribes, and so there was conquest and slavery practiced among the Indian tribes. So what are we talking about? The slavery issue, he gets back to indentured servitude in this country and world slavery. So right today in this great big world, there is slavery that is being practiced. And it's not only minorities or blacks or so forth, but there's white slavery going on out there on a large scale. So slavery is slavery. It's not good anywhere in the world, and it should be stamped out, that's for sure. But it does go on. Now, he didn't really get into, he got into capitalism, didn't explain the crony capitalism as far as I was concerned. So he could have done a little bit better job in explaining some of these things. But overall, I must commend him for saying a lot of very, very good, making very, very good points in this movie. Now, getting back to this 9/11 truth and this 9/11 book and the most dangerous book in the world by S.K. Bain, is that he was part of that. He worked for all these neocons, for all those different publications, but he came out of it. It is possible, see, to be, you know, tied up and to be taken in by wrong views. But there's nothing wrong in changing your opinion and grasping upon a better, more accurate, and a more enlightened view. What I was saying about the creative imagination is that I believe, and on this program I put forward not only the white flag thing, but I put forward two other ideas. And the second idea was about the driving of Putin to the east. And the third idea that I broached with the listening audience was that I believe that the people that have a hard time approaching some of this so-called conspiracy and, you know, and all this are people that have the inability to think in the abstract, in the imaginative world, or the creative creative imagination type of world. And I think with someone that has the ability to think in that, I think that there is an ability then to establish some kind of an idea, no matter how basic it is, of the evil that does exist. We don't want to have people involved in these evil dynamics. But that doesn't mean that they can't begin to study and gather information of people that were involved and that have come out of these evil dynamics and then benefit from that by trying to imagine the world the way it really is. And then when you can begin to creatively imagine the world the way it really is, then I believe you have a more accurate viewpoint, because that would be backed up by factual information from people that were into some of these very evil dynamics and testified as to how they came out of it and how ashamed they were that they were involved in such evil, ritual sacrifice official types of organizations and rituals and so forth. To come out of it, you've got to forgive. To establish the most objective viewpoint, you've got to begin to forgive. Forgiveness brings us out of this. Hatred and resentment and non-forgiveness only takes us to a deeper depth of slavery. Real slavery is when you continue to hate and resent and not let go of those that have transgressed against you. When you can really begin to forgive yourself and others for your misdeeds and your past trespasses, then you can become a new person overnight, instantly, and begin to come out of that slave state and begin a new life that is an enlightened state. I believe that's what real enlightenment is. It's a peace and tranquility that you can only, I believe, attain through walking in the spirit of forgiveness. I know I beat this horse to death all the time, but I'm not going to let go of that. And also, this 9/11 truth, we must stand up for what is right And we cannot let that issue drop and remain ambiguous in the big lie that it is. The 9/11 is a mythology, just like we've been talking about on these 2 hours tonight, that is very powerful, and it's a very powerful, evil mythology that's being practiced upon the American public. And what we must do is we must wake up and come out of that slave state of continuing to hate and resent those that mythologically attacked this country, but in essence, some of our elitists did this dirty job. Thank you for listening.